Stage and studio with host D-May Roberts in just a moment. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's five-part time MBA programs, each designed to provide an educational experience and transformational journey for those who want to move business forward to change the world around them. June 6th information session. Details at merrillhurst.edu. And by the 27th Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival, July 3rd through the 6th at Waterfront Park, which benefits Oregon Food Bank and features Greg Allman, Boz Skaggs, Los Lobos, Maceo Parker, Bombino, Charlie Musselwhite, Ivan Nevels, Dumpsta Funk, and many more. Information, complete schedule, and pass information at waterfrontbluesfest.com.
I'm D-May Roberts, Stage and Studio. We're time traveling today to the pre-war years through World War II and then post-war. Right now we're listening to Glenn Miller's In the Mood. And I'm in the mood to talk with acclaimed author Lisa Si, whose latest novel features the Chinese-American nightclubs from the 1930s through the 1950s. We'll hear about her newly released book. It's just out today. It's called China Dolls. We also have some giveaways, so do stay tuned, because this is Stage and Studio. I'm D-May Roberts. With me live from Los Angeles is my guest author, acclaimed author, Lisa Si. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, it's so nice to be with you again.
Ni hao ma, how are you?
Hello,
Nina. Welcome to Stage and Studio, or welcome back. I was looking at the last time that I talked with you, and it has been almost exactly 3 years since
yes,
I've spoken with you last, because it usually takes you a couple of years, and I can't believe that it doesn't take you longer to write a new book. I mean, first you research, right, for a long period of time, and then you do the writing, and your new book is called China Dolls. And last time we talked, you said, and I'm going to try to refresh your memory, that your next project will be on the Chinese-American nightclubs in New York. But you know what? I asked you about the Forbidden City nightclub, and if you'd seen the wonderful documentary by Arthur Dong about that club, and for Forbidden City, USA, and I was so thrilled that you didn't start with the New York clubs. You actually started with Forbidden City in San Francisco.
Yes, well, that really was the first big Chinese-American nightclub, and that whole scene really started in San Francisco, and then because it was the nightclub era, it did sort of spread across the country, and these performers would go out and travel, and they'd go club to club. And when they did that, they didn't say, we're going out on the Borscht Belt or we're going out on the Chitlin Circuit. They'd say, we're going out on the Chop Suey Circuit.
Yeah.
And actually, the New York club, the China Doll, didn't open until 1946, just after World War II.
Right, because that was the new club then. Well, so you spread out across the country, too, and during research on this book. What was the journey you took from the, around the country when you were trying to collect information and doing interviews about the Chinese-American nightclubs?
I think the main thing was that I did track down several of the performers who were in their late 80s, early 90s, to talk to them about what their experiences were like. I went to Tucson and interviewed a woman, Mary Tom, who was one of the original eight chorus girls at the Forbidden City. She was just an amazing person and was still teaching jazzercise at age 93.
Wow.
I interviewed Dorothy Toy, who was 93 when I interviewed her. She's 97 now. She was billed as the Chinese Ginger Rogers. And it's really fun to go on YouTube and just look for her, because she was just an amazing dancer. And she, Chinese Ginger Rogers, but actually she was Japanese. And then another one who really was a favorite, may have been my, favorite person to interview maybe ever, was a woman named Mai Tai Singh, who was 88 when I interviewed her. And this was someone who had cut a seriously wide swath. I swear, I think she slept with every man in Hollywood and then some. But anyway, she told me all these adventures. I asked her things like, you know, what was your favorite costume? And she said, oh, that's easy. You know, it was a gown made out of 15 yards of monkey fur.
Mm.
Now, you know, that is so not politically correct today, or ever.
No.
But that's not the kind of thing you could never make up.
No.
And so I got these incredible details. Anyway, wide swath. It turns out that the drink, the Mai Tai, was named for her.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Great stories. I mean, you had these great interviews and these great stories. And I also see that you have made a connection with Arthur Dong, too. And for his book version, Forbidden City, USA, you also wrote the foreword for that, too. So there's
yes,
a lot of connections here.
And he was very helpful to me. He has this wonderful collection of ephemera and photographs. And so I would, you know, send him an email and say, well, what kinds of drinks did they have at the Forbidden City or at another nightclub? And then I'd get in the return email, you know, five different drink menus from five different nightclubs.
Oh, that's so amazing. I mean, he has been collecting this since 1989, but a lot of people have been so interested in this history. And what's interesting to me, and when you choose to write about history and to write fiction about history, you had to figure out a creative way to create these fictional characters who can involve the reader in a variety of these clubs and time periods, not just one. Why did you decide to focus on three women to tell the story of these nightclubs?
Well, I think because there's so many different stories that you could tell. And so Grace, I think, is closest to what it was like for most of the performers, a young woman, Chinese, but from the Midwest. This was one of the most surprising things to me, was because most of the girls who actually grew up in Chinatown, they weren't allowed to show their arms or legs in public. They, you know, so traditional. They were home working on their dowry, you know, preparing for weddings and things like that. They just weren't allowed out. And so most of the performers did come out of the Midwest, where they might have been the son or daughter of the only Chinese for hundreds of miles around.
Mm.
And they grew up believing, oh, I'm just like everyone else. And it wasn't until they came west that they actually met and saw other Chinese other than their own families for the very first time. And I think they had this kind of break the mold feeling that they had grown up with, because obviously their own parents had broken the mold to leave Chinatown and go into the middle of the country. So, you know, there was that. Then I did want to have someone who had grown up in Chinatown. And so what would that have taken for a family to allow her to do that? And of course, that's one of the big secrets of the book, and one of the things that certainly propels it along. All these girls have big secrets.
They all have big secrets. Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, there's Ruby, who is Japanese masquerading as Chinese. And there were many, many of these performers who did that because they were Chinese-American nightclubs. Anyway,
so many stories.
But you know, when the war came, this became really a big issue, and how people were able to kind of some of them make it all the way through as Chinese performers. Some were caught and sent to internment camps. Some were sent to internment camps and then sponsored to get out. I interviewed a woman who that had happened to, and she was sponsored to get out, and she went to New York, where she got a job as a dancer. So, you know, I wanted to try to get all of these experiences, and really the best way to do it was through the three friends.
Well, I'm Demay Roberts, stage and studio. My guest is author Lisa C. If you just joined us, you can visit her site at lisac.com. You can also hear this interview later today at stageandstudio.org. And if you have a question for Lisa C., write me now on the Stage and Studio Facebook page at facebook.com/stage, the letter and studio. And you can also tweet me at stage, the letter and studio. Lisa C., you're going to be coming to Powell's on Cedar Hills Crossing on Friday the 13th, actually, Friday, June 13th at 7 p.m., so we're looking forward to seeing you. Now, you have these three friends, Grace, Helen, and Ruby, and they all meet for auditions at Forbidden City. That's just about to open, the first Chinese-American nightclub, and the book follows them through and all the changes and all their secrets and all through pre-war and then World War II and then post-war. And, you know, all of your books have focused on Chinese or Chinese-American characters, but in China Doll, you have, you know, I don't know, is this the first time that you had Chinese-American characters for basically, you know, the whole book, as well as Ruby, who is a Japanese-American character?
I think so.
Yeah,
maybe.
It seemed like a change to me. Mm-hmm. It's not an immigrant story at all.
No, it's definitely not an immigrant story. Everyone was born here.
Exactly.
That's one of the things that they're actually sort of dealing with is, you know, the fact that they were born here, that they are American citizens, that they believe that they're American, and yet what they look like still sets them apart, especially in that time. You know, when you look at a Chinese or an Asian face, and there were so many stereotypes. I think one of the things that really surprised me was when I did research about what happened right after Pearl Harbor, and I looked up the issues of Time and Life, and in them they had these diagrams to show you side by side the difference between a Chinese and a Japanese and how you would be able to tell them apart.
Mm.
You could not print something like that today.
Oh, no. That must have been interesting.
Way. But those are two of our most respected journals and, you know, in sort of American magazine history. And so, you know, I thought that would be very interesting for me to sort of go into that, what that meant. And what that would have meant if you were Chinese, what that would have meant if you were Japanese American, and that these two cultures, which have often, at least, actually in China and Japan, been enemies, long historic enemies, but to look at how that might play out here in the United States.
And it's really sometimes very difficult to go through that part of history too. And but you did, to me, you know, present it in a very objective way, especially a lot of the racism and a lot of the stereotypes that existed back then. In China Doll, you also have Ruby, who is the Japanese American character. She experiences the forced incarceration of Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II, and I really felt that research was very solid too. What kind of research did you do, or did you go to specific camps at all, or memorial places for camps?
My family knew a lot of Japanese Americans who had been interned. My grandfather's very closest friend, Benji Okubo, who was an artist, was sent, and my grandparents and my father, when he was still just a little boy, they took care of a house of another Japanese family that was interned, and they lived in that house for the duration of the war. So I grew up hearing those stories. One of my uncles married a woman who had been interned, so I grew up hearing a lot of those stories. Things like my father, when he was little, took judo, but if you wanted to pass, you know, each level to get a new belt, you went out to Manzanar with your class, and then the people who were interned would do the judging, and yes, you'd get the next level of belt. So I had heard a lot of those stories, but I also did talk to a woman who had been interned, who then was not a dancer, but she had a great love of entertainment, and she would read all of the sort of gossip magazines and movie magazines of the day, and she started writing to the different columnists and just saying, will you sponsor me to get out? It's just unbelievable that somebody would have that idea in the first place, and that in the end, someone did sponsor her. His name was Lee Mortimer, and he was a columnist for the New York Daily Times. And he sponsored her to get out, brought her to New York, got her a job as a dancer. Again, she'd never danced before, but she then spent the rest of her life as a dancer. So to have that first person connection, I think, is really important. You know, I really look at history in I think, a very different way than many people do. You know, we tend to learn history in terms of wars and dates, but really history is about something that happens to real people, to individual people.
Personal stories.
Human stories that we connect to.
Well, I also love that, speaking of first person, that you you played with that writing style by writing first person from all three women friends' perspective. And
that was hard.
I bet. To keep them to tell them apart, essentially. You had to write in three different voices.
Right. And they are so different. And I hope that, you know, when people read this, they really hear these very different voices. Grace from the Midwest, who's really kind of, how can I say this delicately, you know, just fell off the turnip truck.
She was naive. She's
very naive. Yeah. Very, very naive. Helen, who has been through so much and is, you know, from this very traditional family and so often uses a lot of Chinese aphorisms and things like that. And then Ruby, who was born on Terminal Island in Southern California, then Hawaii, then Alameda in San Francisco Bay. What do all of those things have in common? Sailors. So she has this very kind of, you know, she's a bit of a showbiz broad. That all of them are the exact same age, or, you know, within a year or two of each other when the novel starts, they each have come from such different places and from such different perspectives that, of course, that would carry through in how they speak and how they see the world around them.
How did you come to that decision to write in first person?
I really like to write in the first person. I started doing that with Snowflower and the Secret Fan, and I've continued to today. And I think it's a way to really put myself, but hopefully the reader as well, right in the heart of that character, so that you feel like you're really with them. And so, you know, people often say that's the most difficult voice to write from, but I find it the truest, at least for me.
Well, I'm always amazed at how you can make these hard choices when you're looking at what you're going to highlight in history. And I know you do well over a year of research, probably more. You probably don't stop, actually. But then you figure out how to tell the story with your characters and your story, you know, the plot lines. And then, I mean, do you do that first, and then do you then select the historical details, or do you choose the history first and then write around that?
It's a little of both, actually. Sometimes, you know, I'll have an idea. I know I want it to be three friends. I know I wanted it to be in that Chinese-American nightclub scene at the beginning, you know, at the really, and I knew I wanted to write about San Francisco and how transformative this 10 years was, not just for San Francisco, but also the West Coast and the United States as well. I mean, you know, the story opens with the Golden Gate International Exposition that was held in San Francisco, and that's where the term the Pacific Rim was coined. And of course, that, you know, completely made up for that fair, and yet it's something that is still so pertinent to us today. But in those 10 years, you have the Depression, then World War II, then immediately after, you know, the introduction of television and how that really transformed society. So these three huge things that happen within this 10 years. So I sort of know those general kinds of things, and then I just let my imagination go wild, you know, and sometimes I'll be researching something and I'll just come across some little anecdote and I'll think, oh yeah, I've got to use that, you know. So that starts to help form the plot for me, so that I have these kinds of signposts along the way that I know I'm going to get to. I knew, for example, that I wanted Grace to come down to Los Angeles and fail, you know, really fail. I'm not giving too much away, but really fail in to get into the movie business, to be hired as an actress or a singer or a dancer. And so I needed a way for her to have to do that. So, you know, that's a signpost. What's going to happen in San Francisco that drives her out? Then what happens to her in Hollywood? So I have those things, but what happens in between and how they get from here to there, that's the sort of magical part of writing, it seems to me, where you don't really know, and the characters take on a life of their own, they have voices of their own, and they really lead me to from signpost to signpost.
Well, what was the hardest cut you had to make from the original draft? I mean, was there a section that you really didn't want to let go of, but you had to?
Actually, the novel started with all of these performers meeting again at the 50th anniversary.
Oh, really?
And I had a long part where the book was originally just written completely from Grace's point of view. But then I realized, you know, I've got to use all three women's voices. And once I realized that, there was a lot of stuff. First, that first chapter had to go. Then there were, I think, two chapters of Grace in Plain City, Ohio. That all went. That was heartbreaking. And then I got to the end of the book, and it didn't feel quite complete to me. And I took that original first chapter, reworked it, and put it in at the end.
Yeah.
And I think it worked.
I think it works, too.
But you could see, you know, if you've read it, then you could see how you could, that first chapter could have been the setup for this, you know, telling the whole story.
But in some ways, it might have given too much away, too. So
right.
It's interesting to me to hear about your writing process and, you know, just to find out what changes, especially after you've read something that an author makes. Because it could have been anything, really, but you made these hard decisions, and this is what we have. We have China Dolls.
And there were some scenes with Grace in her hometown that it's just... Even now, just thinking about it, it really hurts me.
Oh, wow.
It just really
it's so personal to you, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I think, you know, that's the kind of thing I suppose I could put on my website, although I didn't think of it until just this second. Maybe that I can put that on my list of things to do.
Well, as if you don't have enough. Now, I was actually a little bit surprised that the title was China Dolls, and it didn't come become clear towards the end of the book why you chose that title, because it was the name of a nightclub. But have you had any comment about that term, China Dolls? Because, of course, it's often used as a stereotypical name for an Asian woman.
Right. Well, that's exactly why I wanted to use it.
Really?
Because I wanted to sort of take that stereotype. I mean, this is what they were doing. They were taking the stereotypes about Asian American women, Chinese American women in particular, and just turning it around and turning it on its head. And that was exactly what they were doing every single day. But also this, all of the different ways that you could look at that term, and, you know, a moment when it was seen as a good thing, a moment where it really turns into this very negative stereotype, a moment where there are people who are really actively breaking that stereotype, and then how ironic that, you know, in our main big city, they would actually open a club called
that.
Dolls.
Right, right.
So I don't like to shy away from issues like that. And it just made a lot of sense to be really upfront about it. And one person about 6 months ago when he heard the title, wrote to me and said, you know, are you aware that this is a negative stereotype? And then
oh, no, I'm not aware.
And when I wrote back and explained what I was doing, he completely got it.
Yeah, so, sometimes you have to turn these stereotypes around, you know, mm-hmm. and make people think about it. So, I really appreciate you explaining that. Now, I have to ask you before we go, because we're running out of time. Are you working on researching your next book? Because I know you're on your tour now, your book tour, but...
I am. Well, the research part and the writing will just have to go on vacation.
Good.
For
you need a break. Right.
I did just come back from a big trip to Yunnan province, where I was up in the tea mountains, and this is the birthplace of tea, and I was looking into a very particular tea called Pu'er tea, and I was meeting with farmers and growers and pickers and processors, and there's a man, and these are not the little bushes that we think of as tea. That's all cultivated, but the original tea that people started to drink was in trees. And so this area has trees that are 200, 800, 1,000. There's one tree 3,500 years old that they know was cultivated for tea.
Beautiful.
So there, you know, I met one man who has listed every 1,000-year-old plus tea tree and tracks them on GPS to make sure that they're protected. And you know, so I met everyone, sort of the whole gamut of the whole world of tea in that particular area.
Well, there's a little idea there. We'll see how it blossoms in the next couple of years.
Right, and then when I come back, you're going to tell me what that...
You told me the story about tea, Lisa. Do you remember that? Yeah, of course you do. So Lisa C. comes to Portland on Friday, June 13th at 7 p.m. at Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing. And that's located at 3415 Southwest Cedar Hills Boulevard. And for more info, call 7323. Find out more about China Dolls and Lisa C's other books at lisac.com, and we'll have that link at stageandstudio.org, as well as this entire interview. Such a pleasure to talk with you, Lisa C. See
Thanks
you in Portland.
Yes.
You take care.
Thank you so much. You too.
Before we go today, some announcements and a giveaway. Forbidden City USA by Arthur Dong. He writes about the magic and glamour of the Chinese-American nightclub scene, which peaked in San Francisco during World War II. We've been hearing about that. In this book, it's a nonfiction book. Arthur Dong includes previously unpublished personal stories along with over 400 stunning images and rare artifacts of from the documentary film that's in this book, Forbidden City USA, and it chronicles Asian American performers who defied racial and cultural barriers of those times to pursue their showbiz dreams. And Forbidden City USA, the book, is based on his previous documentary film, so check that out. Lisa C. also writes a foreword in this new complete book of Asian American nightclubs from 1936 to 1970, and for more info, go to forbiddencitybook.com. And now the ticket giveaway. Imago Theater presents Pimento and Pullman by Thornton Wilder, June 12th and 15th, Thursday 7 p.m., Friday at 8, Saturday 3 and 8, and Sunday at 3 p.m. Tickets are give what you can, so call Imago at 503-231-9581, 231-9581, or online at Tickets West, and that's ticketswest.com or 503-224-8499. And the show is recommended for 16 years or older. Imago Theater closes its season with Pullman Car Hiawatha, which is about a Pullman car that winds its way from New York to Chicago, and it's kind of a metaphysical and metaphorical journey. And second one act is a clown piece, so, you know, that's the one that's rated R. For more info, visit imagotheater.com or call 503-231-9581. We have a pair of tickets to offer to the first caller here at KBOO for the Thursday or Sunday show. Call now at 503-231-8032, 231-8032. That's it for Stage and Studio. And don't forget to join us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/stage_n_studio or tweet me at @StageNStudio. Till next time, I'm Dimae Roberts.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, with a keynote speaker on June 6th and all-day conference June 7th at Portland State University. Voices on the Ground is hosted by the Social Welfare Action Alliance and the School of Social Work at PSU, with the goal of providing space for the larger community of activists and organizations to connect and engage students and the broader community in an effort to build meaningful, collaborative relationships. Again, that's Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Up next is Art Focus with host Joseph Galavan. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from McMenamin's Edgefield, presenting two evenings with the Avett Brothers this September, touring behind their latest album, Magpie and the Dandelion. Avett Brothers tickets are on sale now at edgefieldconcerts.com.
Looks a scream, and him on my woe, and he woe, silver scream, can't tell them apart.
My name's Joseph Galavan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Janelle Baglian. She owns Studio Art Direct, which is a fine art consulting firm here in Portland, specializing in regional artists for healthcare, hospitality, corporate, and government projects. Welcome to KBOO, Janelle.
Thank you.
So people might have visited the Kaiser Permanente Westside Medical Center, which is a brand new hospital in Hillsborough, and noticed that the art there is pretty, there's a lot of it and it's very good. And you are responsible for curating that art. So could you just tell us a little bit about that pro-